Hello and welcome to COVIDcast, a Lowy Institute podcast for anyone interested in understanding the effect of coronavirus on global politics and international life. My name is Alexander Dayant, and I am a research fellow at the Lowy Institute in Sydney, Australia. As this crisis unfolds, we are sitting down every week with experts from a range of fields to discuss the implications of coronavirus for the world. In this episode, I'll be speaking with one of the most vibrant political economists of our time, Professor Yanis Varoufakis. Yanis is an economist, philosopher, author, and co-founder of Democracy in Europe Movement 2025, also called DiEM25. He is currently a member of the Hellenic Parliament. As one of nine representatives of Mera 25, the Greek wing of DiEM25, and also served as the Greek Minister of Finance from January to July 2015. Yanis has a remarkable span of accomplishments and skills. His publications go way beyond traditional economics, but also include very important interventions on the Eurozone crisis debate, the Greek debt crisis problem, and he has published a series of books on capitalism, globalization, automation, and democracy. Yanis, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Alexander. It's always a pleasure to be conversing with the Lowy Institute, whose work I know and I appreciate for many years now. So let's do it.
So I want to ask you first about your background. It seems that you have lived a life full of transition. I mean, you were born in Greece, but you studied in the UK and became an academic at the University of Essex. You then moved to Australia and became a lecturer at the University of Sydney for a bit more than 10 years. Mm-hmm. After that, you went back to Greece and started a political career where you have had a very active role since the global financial crisis. All of this while cultivating a profile as a global intellectual. What can you tell us about your time in Australia? And most importantly, what's next?
Well, I escaped to Australia because at the tender age of 17, 18, I moved from my native Greece to Britain about a year before Thatcher got into 10 Downing Street. So I lived during the tsunami of Thatcherism for 10 years. A very interesting time. I cut my political, analytical, cultural teeth there. I went from being an undergraduate to a graduate student, a doctoral student to a lecturer. I moved from one university to another. And I received, out of the blue, I never applied for a job. I received an offer from the University of Sydney for a lectureship. Initially, I said, yeah, right, as if I'm going to go to Australia. But then later, I thought, well, why not? This is, if you're going to escape somewhere, you might as well escape to Oz. You know, I had a brilliant time. I went from Cambridge University to Sydney University, which was considered a very dumb career move, but I don't regret it. Sydney University in the late 80s was an oasis compared to what it is today, to what British universities are. An oasis from, you know, the fake marketization of education. There were right-wingers, there were left-wingers, there were, you know, centrists, there were economists from different schools of thought. There was room to think and to write and to debate. So my first few years in Australia were quite astoundingly good. And it was also a time when under the Labour government of the late 80s, early 90s, you had the flourishing of ideas of anti-racism. And then everything started closing down. I felt that Thatcherism was following me to Australia. The reforms in the university sector were a copy of what was happening in Britain. And actually, it even went further with the introduction of HECS and marketization of our degrees and so on. So at some point, I felt, you know, the honeymoon was over. It took 7-8 years. And then I started plotting my return to Europe. And I didn't come back to Greece to be a politician. I have to say that. I went to the University of Athens. I became an accidental politician 10 years after I went back to Greece. Actually, 15 years after I went back to Greece, because, you know, I couldn't keep my mouth shut. And I kept criticizing the economic policies of the government. And at some point, my critique became quite prominent. And a young man who was going to become prime minister turned around and said, well, put your money where your mouth is. Do you want to be finance minister? I thought, oh my God, what have I done?
Now, well, let me ask you a question about Europe. So as you know, like many parts of the world, the COVID-19 crisis has put a lot of pressure on the continent and has drained the monetary union to a breaking point. Nonetheless, after intense negotiation, the European leaders have signed a groundbreaking agreement for a new EU finance recovery fund that has been hailed as Europe's first move towards, you know, a genuine integration and a fiscal union. But you have been critical of this agreement, Yanis, and I was wondering if you could expand on those critics. You know, like it seems that for many European observers, this was a very important move in the history of the Union. And I mean, we know that you are a supporter of the Union. So why did you criticize the agreement?
I'm glad you said what you said right at the end, because my criticism of the European Union is not a Eurosceptic criticism. It's a Europeanist criticism. I think that, you know, we are not doing enough in order to turn Europe into a realm of shared prosperity, into a genuine union. The problem with the European Union is that it is not a union. It's a disunion, which is becoming more disunited and fragmented with every crisis that hits it. And the reason is because the architecture has never been fit for purpose. Now, let me cut to the chase. The main problem is that we have a monetary union without a political union. To put it slightly more technically, we have created a central bank that doesn't have a state behind it, and 19 states that don't have a central bank behind them. Yeah, that is a recipe for disaster, right? So in the European Monetary Union, we don't have common debt. We don't have common taxation. We do not have a central bank that can actually, in difficult times, support either the banking system through injections of capital, not liquidity, and it cannot support the state. So between 2008, 2010, and 2020, the way they have kept together the Eurozone was by means of a combination of bailout loans that were given, on the one hand, to banks, and on the other hand, to governments. But these loans were given to bankrupt entities. You know, Greece has received three packages of, you know, more than 100 billion euros each. And also the money that has been extended to banks in order to keep them afloat has then been transferred on to corporations in a process of zombification. So corporations and banks now in Europe may look healthy, but they're not. They're zombies. They are, you know, the living dead, because they rely entirely on the central bank for loans that cannot be repaid. And all this is bought at the expense of austerity. So, you know, the little people get crushed. And the result, of course, is the poisoning of our democracies. This is why you have right-wingers and nationalism and xenophobia and racism rising up everywhere. So what was decided to create in the wake of COVID-19, a recovery fund that for the first time would answer the criticisms that are just waged? The recovery fund has been hailed as a path-breaking moment because it involves common debt for the first time.
Yes.
And that is a good thing. So why am I whinging, as an Aussie might say? Because we've done it in a toxic way. We've done it in a way that's not going to help. If anything, it's going to hinder. The Commission, the European Commission, which is the nearest we have to a federal government, but it's not a government because it doesn't have the capacity to tax, right? And it now has been given the capacity to borrow. It doesn't have the capacity to tax, but it's been given the capacity to borrow on behalf of everybody else. Some, which is not that large. You know, it's 750 billion over a period, you know, of 30 years. That comes to 1% of GDP for the next 5 years. It's microeconomically insignificant. Before they borrowed a certain amount of money, they had to agree on how much of that money will go to each country. Imagine the toxicity of that negotiation. And because, you see, the Federation must also be fair in the sense that what sounds like a right wing, but it's not, I think it's a left wing criticism of the recovery fund. The way they're going to do it now, the poorest of the Germans are going to take out loans from which the only people who will benefit are the rich Greeks and the rich Italians. Because, you know, this money is going to be raised through taxation across Europe, particularly in Germany and Holland. Who pays taxes? The poor people, because the rich people have very good, very efficient ways of minimizing their tax. And the money will come to Greece, but it won't go to the Greeks. The Greeks are suffering austerity. It will go to the Greek oligarchs. You know, the same people who threw our country to the rocks in 2010. You know, once again, Europe has proven remarkable at the propaganda game, at celebrating another breakthrough, another fantastic miracle decision, which is taking us down the wrong road. You see, most people criticize the European Union for not going fast enough in the right direction. I accuse of the European Union of going very fast in the wrong direction.
So you're saying the EU Commission hasn't learned really from the mistake it did in the past. But what about other members of the Troika? From January to July 2015, you served as the Greek Minister of Finance. And during that time, you famously led negotiations with Greece's creditor during the government debt crisis, one of which was the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. On the back of this, what do you think is the role of the IMF in the current crisis?
Well, you see, the International Monetary Fund was created as an instrument of the Bretton Woods system. And the IMF's role in that context was meant to keep exchange rates fixed. That was the original remit of the IMF. And in the process of keeping the exchange rate between the Aussie dollar and the American dollar fixed, there would be times during which a trade deficit that Australia had vis-a-vis the United States would have to somehow be financed in the short term by IMF loans in order to keep Bretton Woods going. But in 1971, Richard Nixon, on the 15th of August, if I remember correctly, blew the whole place up, the whole Bretton Woods system. And, you know, suddenly we went from fixed exchange rates to floating exchange rates. The IMF's purpose simply disappeared. What it did since then was to act as the bailiff of Western banks in third world countries. So when Western banks would face a very serious threat of default from a Kenyan or the Nigerian government or the Ghanese government, because the international economic crisis pushed interest rates up and suddenly, you know, Kenya could not repay its debts, the IMF would come in and say, okay, we will lend you some money on conditions of severe austerity, the so-called structural adjustment programs, and you have to privatize schools, you have to reduce public education expenditure, public health, and sell your railways, sell your ports, and so on and so forth. So it behaved like a bailiff on behalf of international finance. In this context, there's very little the IMF can do today. In this remarkable collapse of global capitalism, where both demand and supply suffer simultaneously, the IMF could have a fantastically therapeutic and important role, but it's not playing that role because it is not given the remit by Washington, D.C., and by the international financial sector to do it. So instead, you know, it is again negotiating with Argentina, with Ecuador, with various defaulters on behalf of international finance.
I was wondering if you could explain, at the beginning of the crisis, the Australian share market, like many other markets around the world, has left investors scratching their heads. After a massive fall in March, the market rebounded quite significantly by June. And in the meantime, Australia's economy has plunged into its first economic recession in 29 years, you know, as it suffers the economic fallout from coronavirus. So, yeah, I was wondering if you could explain this disconnect between the financiers and the real economy.
It is quite a remarkable disconnect, isn't it? For the first time in the history of capitalism, you've got this awful, horrible, hideous plunge of the real economy, and financial markets are doing very well, thank you. They have their ups and downs, but, you know, financiers are making a mint at the moment. How do you explain that? I think the explanation lies in seeing what happened after 2008. In 2008, the financial sector of the West collapsed, and it was refloated by central banks. But this led to a kind of zombification of the corporate world. Let me give you an example. The combination of socialism for the financiers, you know, effectively giving the money, public money, and austerity for everybody else, meant that every time let's take the European Central Bank here, they print €1 billion, hoping to lend it to banks, hoping that the banks will then lend it on to the private sector. The private sector will invest, new jobs, recovery. So they pick up the phone from Frankfurt and they call, Deutsche Bank or Societe Generale, a commercial bank, and say, I have €1 billion here, free, you know, zero interest rates, or more or less 0.001% interest rates. Do you want it? The bank will say, yes, of course. It's free money. Then the bank has to think, okay, who am I going to lend this to? I'm not going to lend it to the little people, you know, small and medium-sized firms, because they're not doing well. And looking at consumers, they are not going to be doing well because they have stagnant wages, they have falling living standards. They're not going to be able to repay such a huge new loan. So what they do is Societe Generale or Deutsche Bank pick up the phone and they call Volkswagen, a large company. And they say to Volkswagen, I've got a billion here. Do you want it? It's minuscule interest rate. Volkswagen says, okay, give it to me. But then Volkswagen looks at the people out there and says, ah, they are not going to be able to afford a Tesla-like expensive new electric car. So I'm not going to invest in new electric car technology. So how am I going to benefit as Volkswagen from this, as the CEO of Volkswagen? Simply take the billion and go to the stock exchange and buy Volkswagen shares, because that pushes the share price up. Your salary and your bonus is connected to the share price. So what has happened is all this economic activity has bolstered the financial sector. Share prices are up, but nothing's happening in the real economy. That, I think, is what explains. You throw into this mix COVID-19, which turbocharges this whole thing, and you've got the financial world skyrocketing, leaving the Earth's orbit and moving towards another star system, yeah? And miserable industrial market-based capitalism suffering in its wake. This is the situation we have. For me, this is, you know, moving beyond capitalism, because for the first time in the history of capitalism, wealth has been decoupled from profit. If you look at the situation in the financial markets, you have no profits. No profits. Dividends are zero. And yet those who play in the stock exchange make a lot of money. So, yeah, when you see that, capitalism is all about profit. Profit seeking, profit maximization. Every student of economics knows that it's all about profit. If there is zero profit, but there is a lot of concentration of wealth, you know, this is a kind of feudalism. It's a kind of technologically advanced, you know, Facebook-based and Amazon-based feudalism.
All right. Well, that's interesting. So maybe Yannis, clearly, like, I mean, we need a solution, right? And that leads me perfectly to my next question, which is going to be my last question for you. And it's going to be about your latest book, Another Now. So the silver lining of the COVID-19 pandemic is that it has shined lights onto social and economic systems all across the world, exposing some of the flaws of a capitalist society. In your book, you present an alternative to our current capitalist system. It is not a manuscript on the Soviet Union, but rather a description on what a fair and equal society would look like. Just taking into account what you just told us about this disconnect, you know, like between the financial and the real economy, could you give us a brief description and tell us how your vision has changed since the beginning of the pandemic?
It hasn't changed much, I have to tell you, because I think that the crisis of 2008 is the one we're still experiencing, except that it's been enhanced, deepened, and made far worse by COVID-19. Look, I think that at the beginning of your question, you embedded within the broader question the most pertinent pressing issue. What do we do? Given, if I'm right in my analysis of capitalism having effectively transcended itself, what do we do? Well, a Green New Deal for the world is the immediate remedy. So we need, just like Roosevelt in 1933, used public finance in order to shift a lot of the liquidity from the private bank, private sector, and pressed it into the service of creating jobs. We need to do the same thing, but we need to do it at a global scale, and not just to rebuild existing brown industries, but to create new green ones. To take all this liquidity from the financial sector and invest it into the green, high-quality jobs that both the planet and society needs. That's the first thing we need to do. But my book, and thank you for mentioning Another Now, tries to go beyond that, because this is a short-term solution. It will not address all those dynamics embedded within capitalism that are spewing this sequence of crises that brought us where we are. So we need a short-term fix, that's the International Green New Deal, but we also need to think beyond capitalism, because, you know, capitalism is transcending itself and undermining itself anyway. So can we imagine what the next system will be? And I try to do this in this book. And I try to do it using the techniques of a political science fiction novel. And the reason why I do this, Alexander, is this. Anybody who tries to sit down and write a utopia, a blueprint for the world for the future, is mad and megalomaniac, right? Because none of us can depict completely and in an integrated manner what the world would be like. I mean, nobody could do it in the 16th century. Nobody could describe how capitalism would work. It would be an interesting attempt, but they wouldn't be able to do it. I disagree with myself about many things regarding what a democratized economy should look like. So what I did, in order to give an opportunity to myself to express these disagreements that I have with myself, is that, you know, I turned into a novel and I have three different characters. One of them is a radical Marxist feminist revolutionary. Another one is a neoliberal, another woman, a neoliberal professor of economics who used to work for Lehman Brothers in New York City. And the third one is a technologist, completely caught up in artificial intelligence and in all those things that supposedly will liberate us from drudgery and create mechanical slaves that do all the chores on our behalf. So those three are having arguments amongst each other, right? And also discover that in another dimension, after 2008, there was a high-tech, peaceful, but strong, powerful revolution that created another now, a different way of having a market economy without the two markets that make capitalism capitalism, labor markets and money markets. So is it possible to imagine a market society that is technologically advanced and democratic without a labor market and a share market? And that's what I try to answer in the book. And my characters discover that, they stumble upon such a society, and they have huge arguments amongst each other in assessing it.
Do you think it's attainable, reachable for us?
I do think so. But there are two different questions. One is it attainable? And the other is it likely? I cannot answer the second question. But you know what? If you and I were, in London or New York in the year 1800, and somebody were to describe capitalism to you, the end of slavery, the way in which financial markets work, the way in which labor markets work, we would have thought that this is pie in the sky stuff. So I think it's tenable. And I think we have an obligation and a moral duty to imagine it. Because come to think of it, in the 1930s, there would be no New Deal in the United States. There would be no great society legislation by LBJ. There would be no civil rights movements if people didn't have a capacity back then to imagine the unimaginable.
Well, I think that's a positive note, right? Let us hope that we all be able to live in another now in the future. Anyway, thank you very much, Yanis, for taking the time joining me today on the podcast. And all the best to you in the weeks and months ahead, especially with the new book.
Thank you so much to all of you, to the Lowy Institute.
COVIDcast is a limited edition podcast from the Lowy Institute. Thank you to my colleagues Roland Raja and Madeleine Neist for helping me prepare for this interview, and Jennifer Reinhardt for production assistance. Keep an eye on our social media channels for details of the next episode of COVIDcast. And you can stay up to date with all the previous episodes on the homepage of our website. Thank you all for listening today, and stay tuned for our next episode.